Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Thanks very much indeed, and thanks for coming. It wasn't very difficult to leave minus 20 Norway and come to Santa Barbara, trust me. It's a pleasure to be here, really. What I'd like to talk about today, I'm a photographer who works principally on humanitarian issues, and what I try to do is highlight humanitarian crises that are slightly underreported or not reported at all in the world, and that job has kind of taken me from Sierra Leone, Liberia, Central African Republic, Rwanda, Congo, Darfur, Somalia, Nepal, just to mention a few of the places that we have underreported crises in the world. And it's kind of shocking that we do in today's world, because there are enough media outlets out there and there is enough interest, I think, from the consumers of news. As you can see tonight, this auditorium is full, and sometimes the magazines and the media define and try to tell us what it is and what we think we need to see in our magazines and newspapers, and I think sometimes the readers know a little bit better what it is they need to be reading. But what I try to do now is to take you through a journey of some of those issues and some of the issues that concern me as a photographer and a journalist, but more importantly concern me as a human being, because what I try to do with the work is I choose work that I feel quite passionate about representing and recording. And so what I try to do today is show you some of that body of work. We'll start with, I've been covering a small country, a small part of a country in Africa, that when I called somebody up in November 2003 and asked if I could go there, they didn't know who that was, where that was, and I got a similar response from several different magazines. This small place that nobody had heard of was called Darfur, and it was about November 2003 when I called Time magazine, who said they couldn't send me there. And then I called Newsweek, they couldn't send me there. New York Times couldn't send me there. The LA Times couldn't send me there. Stern magazine, Le Monde, The Telegraph, Time magazine, all of these international magazines were concentrating on Iraq and Afghanistan and the up-and-coming then 2004 presidential elections. And they didn't really think that this situation in Darfur was very important. So I called another organization that I work with quite regularly called Human Rights Watch. And 3 days later, I had the funds and the support to go to Darfur and record what was going on there. And over the next 6 months, I spent, probably 4.5 of the next 6 months in country recording the human rights abuses that were going on there. And what I'd try and take you through now is some of those images. But I've been going back there ever since, and I've probably been to Darfur now about 8 times. Thankfully, after about the 3rd or 4th month, the magazines got a little bit more interested in the story, and they thought that, you know, maybe there was something here, maybe there was something they should be involved in. But sometimes we unfortunately have to push a little bit too hard with the media outlets to get stories that are valuable and valid into play. And sometimes when you read things in the newspapers and the magazines, there are journalists and photographers behind those stories that are really sometimes fighting really quite hard to get that sort of work in, and this sort of work doesn't sell BMWs or diamond watches very well, so sometimes magazines don't like publishing it. My work involves I like the aesthetic nature of images, and I like to try and mix the harsh reality of journalism with the aesthetic nature of what a picture can be, because I think that allows us as consumers of pictures and as consumers of news a poetic pause And some of these images are, and this one specifically tells you nothing. It doesn't tell you anything about where we are, what we're doing, who we're talking about. But there's a poetic quality to my thought process when I'm recording some of these images. This is a displaced camp in Chad, and it's actually now a town. As you can see, it's quite organized. It's quite well put together. It started out with just tents, and actually now the displaced have built houses around the tents. There are walls around the houses. There are shops. It's become a mini city. But this place was set up in 2004, probably July 2004, and now houses 60,000 people. Unfortunately, just opposite this camp, on the other side of those mountain ranges, is another camp. These people in this camp are Sudanese. The people over the hills are Chadian, because this conflict that we're talking about in Darfur is not just in Darfur anymore. The systematic ethnic cleansing and what I would define as genocide that is going on inside Darfur is now going on in Chad and Central African Republic. And so these three states now are experiencing the same level of ethnic cleansing and genocide that we saw in early 2004, 2005. And actually, just last week in Darfur, this whole process of bombardment started again. Child soldiers are a huge problem, not just in Darfur, but worldwide. And unfortunately, I have had the chance to record quite a lot of child soldiers working around the world. These are members of the Sudanese Liberation Army, one of the rebel movements working in Darfur. When the attacks come on villages, there's normally aerial bombardments followed by Janjaweed attacking villages on land and burning everything that they can find, and this is kind of evidence of that. This was an image that I actually couldn't quite believe it when I saw it. It's the gate of a hospital run by Doctors Without Borders, just after we were attacked by Sudanese rebels. And for me, this kind of represented the death of peace. This, to me, looks like a dove with its head amputated, and to which through you see this these military kind of driving past. About four RPGs landed in the hospital that day, and the doctors from Doctors Without Borders just carried on working. They operated on 55 people that day. This guy was one of them. Phosphorus bombs are internationally banned. Shouldn't be used. Absolutely not. Shouldn't be manufactured. But they're being used and dropped out of helicopters in Darfur on a daily basis. And that's the effect. This child is 14 years old. Sometimes when you're working in these regions, you have to ask for the help of either NGOs or organizations like Human Rights Watch to get you into places. And on this particular occasion, I was working with Doctors Without Borders or Médecins Sans Frontières. In Europe, we call it Médecins Sans Frontières, which is Doctors Without Borders in French. But sometimes the way that these guys are working, they mingle. So I know that there's quite a lot of kind of global policy, and there are a lot of people maybe here that are thinking of working for these sorts of NGOs in the future. But this is why I put this image in. But it shows you the proximity to the battle. You know, we're moving from one house to another, and this is the front line. This is a battle going on between Sudanese rebels and Chadian rebels. And you're crossing a border. There are shots going off here. There are RPGs exploding, and the doctors are going to the hospital to operate. And sometimes, you know, if you're going to work for these organizations, those are the situations that unfortunately you're going to have to find yourself in. These guys are incredible. I go in and I come out, but these guys stay there for months and months and months. This was a lady who was just in her house, and her house exploded around her, and she lost one of her eyes, and the child thankfully had quite significant head wounds, but both of them survived. The resilience of the population in Chad is incredible, and I find it quite humbling. Just the day after the house is burnt down and bombarded, what I would normally do probably is sit there and feel sorry for myself, but the Chadians just stand up and rebuild immediately. I mean, immediately. This is the morning after their houses were burnt by Janjaweed. They're setting up exactly where their houses used to be. This kid was, we weren't sure, between 13 and 14 was a guess. He was a Sudanese boy whose father and brothers had been killed in an attack by Janjaweed on his village. And he'd fled, at that time he was 9 years old, and he'd fled to a camp in Chad where he was recruited by the Sudanese Liberation Army as a cook and a runner, a sort of general help around the soldiers. And he's angry, you know, 9, 10 years old. He wants to fight for his country, but he's too young. And this is kind of how child soldiers, in some respects, sometimes this is how they start. They're bored. They have no education in the camps. They feel lost. They feel very angry. And then... one of their friends comes to them and said that they're working for the Sudanese Liberation Army. Would they like to come? So off he goes. And this story goes on and on. So many children are recruited in a very similar fashion. He runs around for a couple of years doing errands in the military camps, sees all these people around him with guns. They become his new family. They become... he aspires to be one of them. You know, they're his heroes. And by the time he gets to 13 years old... He's growing. He's getting stronger. He can play around with a Kalashnikov if he wants. There are special children's versions of Kalashnikov that are made in China, and they're smaller, they're lighter, and so these kids can carry them. And one day, his village is attacked by the Janjaweed, and the village where the Sudanese Liberation Army are based. And his best friend that invited him to join the SLA, who was also the same age as him, was killed. He gets very angry, and he goes to his commander and said, I want to be a fighter, I want to be a soldier. So this was his first soiree out into the battle, and he was so stoned on marijuana on the back of one of the trucks as they were flying through the desert at 90 miles an hour that he fell off the back, and the impact of hitting the dirt ripped his foot off his leg. Quite soon after this, his leg was amputated. And so I just wanted to tell you that story because sometimes we don't quite understand what child soldiers are all about or how they get there or how they get recruited. This is one of the ways. There are many others, and some other images I'll show you later on. But this is one kind of story that really affected me because he was there, amputated, 14 years old, no family. In the bed in the same ward was a child who was 14 years old and amputated and had no family. He was a result of being attacked by his soldiers. And so you have two children that represent what is happening to tens of thousands of children in Chad and Darfur and Central African Republic. And that story for me always resonates, and it always is important in my own kind of psyche of trying to understand what's going on here. A lot of the time, As photographers and as journalists, we have to use the different military groups to travel around because there's no transport in these areas, and to travel in your own transport is too dangerous. Your vehicle's going to get hijacked. So a lot of the time we have to travel and live with the military groups that are operating out there. This is this was taken in Chad, just at the end of last year, the middle of last year, and this is a Janjaweed who's looting one of the villages that have been burnt by by his men a couple of days earlier, and very close to the displaced camp we saw right at the start of this series. And these people, they're going through, picking out the remains of what's left of these houses, going back and using it in the village. The board you see, the big vessel that you see on the right hand side of the frame, is where people keep rice in, and grains, and obviously that's emptied out and stolen. So as you can see, I mean, when we talk about ethnic cleansing, when we talk about these attacks on these villages, these people are quite literally left with absolutely nothing. And nothing to go back to. The insecurity in these areas, there's no way they can come back and live in these areas. And for many, many years, they sit with, in these camps, wanting to go back home to these places. The international community says, it's now calm, it's now peaceful, we don't hear it in the news. But still, these villages are empty. These are Janjaweed fighters in Sudan. This image for me is one of those images that it kind of sums up the desolation and the desperate nature of the fight for life. I'm not too sure if many of you are aware of how the conflict in Darfur started, but it's all about land. And I was just discussing earlier on before the lecture started about conflicts, and I'd be interested maybe later on if anyone can come up with one. But I don't know a single conflict historically, currently, that isn't involved and fought along, created by and also solved by economics. I think economics is the source of every single conflict that I know, and the solution for every conflict is economics. And that could be, by economics, I'm talking about the fight for land or the fight for power, the fight for the control of water, the fight for the control of the most lucrative natural resources. And here in Darfur, the conflict started because of land. Desertification has affected this part of the African continent quite severely. And Arab nomads who had to feed their cattle came further and further south to feed on the land of the Black African Darfurians, and that created tension, it created conflict. The Arab nomads then went to Khartoum to ask for a solution, and here we are 4 years later. But this is what they're fighting over. And for me, I just get so surprised that we can't find a solution. If this is what they're fighting over, can we not find another solution? Is not something that we can do here. And there are many conflicts around the world that we can kind of be critical about, but at least we can look towards finding a solution. And I think Darfur is one of those ones where I don't know what the solution is. I don't know how we can solve this issue, how we can solve this problem. And that, for me, is quite a depressing concept. I mean, this isn't his gun, but it's his father's. But the proximity of weapons and children, it's like the proximity of Lego and children. It becomes the toy. It becomes the norm in the house. It becomes part of life. And this is again why we're seeing quite, a huge surge in this particular area of child soldiers. This was a part of a story I did on sexual violence. And sexual violence in Darfur, amongst many other states around the world, is being used increasingly as a weapon of war. And the insecurity to the female population in the camps in Chad, in the camps in Darfur, in Congo, it's all the same. It's something the international community should be doing something more than it's doing, that's for sure, to try and protect women in these areas. But the decision that's made by the local population is that if a man goes out to collect wood during the day or collect water during the day, he'll be killed. If a woman goes out to collect wood or water during the day, she'll only be raped. So the women go out and collect wood and water. And that's the decision that's made by every family in these camps. And what's happening now increasingly is that the international community is starting to accompany these women. And it's quite interesting that now once the accompanying of the women has started, then it shifts over and the men are now collecting wood. So when the international community, when the African Union forces go with these women or with these people to collect wood, the men can do it a little bit more efficiently, and so they can collect more wood in a shorter period of time, that's so they think, and so it shifts, the gender shifts. But it's quite interesting that families actually sit down and discuss this, you know. You go to work every day, you come to college every day, and the decisions that you make are, you know, do I go on my bike or my car? And the decisions that these guys make is, do we send a man and he'll be killed, or do I send a woman and she'll be raped? Let's go and send the woman. This is an attack on a village by Antonovs. They were dropping bombs on this village just the day before. And you know, there were four or five houses in this area, and it's completely shattered. And then Janjaweed come in later on and burn and loot, and there's nothing left. Again, back on this issue of child soldiers. This young lad is probably 14 or 15, but he's a soldier for the National Army in Chad, and the National Army is financed and sponsored by the United Nations, and more specifically France and the European Union, but it's actively recruiting children, and still nobody questions the fact that this active recruitment is going on. There was a statement made by a French foreign minister about 8 or 9 months ago, and some threat of the withdrawal of aid, but that never happened, and still the recruitment goes on. This was taken at a time in 2004 when the Sudanese government said that there was no aerial bombardment going on. So this was an image actually that ran, one of the first images that ran in this series in the States, when I think it was the day or the week after the BBC had interviewed the Ministry of Defense in Sudan, and he categorically denied that there was any aerial bombardment going on. So this ran as a double page spread in Time magazine 6 months after it happened. But again, I question, you know, what the fight is all about when the land that we're talking about, this is the land. This is an image for me which kind of defined the brutality. This was a time, I found this mass grave in Darfur in early 2004, and everyone had been put in this hole, but then about 500-600 meters away, this particular area was, many bodies like this were kind of spread out, and they were all the young men, sort of 12 years old up to 20 years old, and they were left there as signs to the rest of the population not to get involved in the conflict. And this became a very effective tool by the Janjaweed, kind of leaving these bodies everywhere. as a sign. I mean, the women and the children, they were thrown in a big hole and covered up because they didn't want anyone to know they'd done that. But these young boys, they were signals to every other young boy not to get involved. And this, for me, kind of sums up this desperate struggle. You know, these women had walked 25 kilometers with whatever was left of their homes. It was a donkey and a barrel and a few tins. That's what remains of their life. You know, even their husbands and their children had gone. And this is all that's left. And for me, this kind of desperate struggle for life is kind of summed up with this image. You know, this image I took in 2004, but I have a very similar image that I took in 2007. And again, I question, after all this, all these words are written and all these pictures are published and all this pontificating by the UN and by the international community and the pressure that we try and apply, yet still it happens. This issue is definitely something that we should look back, and history will look back at us and we should be ashamed of what we've done and not done. We were talking earlier on to a class here in the college about why has, for example, Darfur got so much press and attention, and other countries like Congo, where the death toll is much larger, and I'll show you some images from there a little later on, where why the issue is that that there's so much more attention on Darfur. My response, and it's purely a personal opinion, was that because of the huge kind of Christian right movement to maintain awareness in Darfur, quite rightly, has led to a very effective coverage of this conflict and maintaining awareness within the press and within kind of daily life for the average American and the average European. It's in the papers. Whether we do anything about it that's effective is a different matter, but the awareness is there. But when you mention that, for example, 5.4 million people have been killed in Congo, I'm not too sure how many people are aware of that statistic in the last 10 years. And we had this discussion about why that is. And one of the things I think is the Darfur issue is misunderstood slightly, because many of the populist press try to put it across as a Muslim conflict against African Christians, which is not the case at all. Both sides have a very strong Muslim faith. There are some Christians in Darfur, but not very many. And if there's any religion that prevails on both sides, it's a Muslim faith. But I think it's kind of interesting that this perception of religion has defined the interest in that story. I think that's like a question that we should be taking away with us and ask. Because it becomes like one religion against another, it's something that we should be investing in and being interested in. But if it was Muslim against Muslim, then we should not be interested in it. And it's kind of quite an interesting question that we should always have in our minds. I don't know what the answer is on why, but it's one that I always find quite interesting, that kind of misconception. This was a group of people that I bumped into as I was driving through the desert. And This was a whole village that were just sat under a tree during the day. They were all displaced. They were all on the move. And I asked them, was it because of the heat of the day that they weren't moving? And they said, no, we're staying under this tree to protect ourselves from the bombing. And then I drove on further, and I saw hundreds of these trees where, you know, at least, what do we have, 200, 250 people under these trees waiting until nightfall, so that then they can move, so that the Antonovs don't see them. And the trees for them are the cover, not just from the sun, but from the Antonovs and the bombing. Their villages don't exist anymore. It's the only place they have to go. This couple have lost everything. They lost their cattle. They lost their goats. The last thing they had was their camel. And that also died. And so their whole possessions, they just sat in the middle of the desert with nowhere to go, nowhere to carry what they have. This is SLA. This was my taxi for about 3 weeks. But, I've always kind of wanted to feel like Lawrence of Arabia, but this whole thing was a little bizarre. And to kind of cover this conflict like this was also very bizarre. But it's the only way that you can get to cover these areas sometimes. And again, you know, once we set up, you know, the international community sets up camps in these areas, and we think that everything's going right. This United Nations High Commission for Refugees is working in this area. UNICEF is working in this area. MSF is working in this area. But still, you know, the water doesn't get through, and then you have a humanitarian crisis that is, you know, gets out of hand very, very quickly, especially with cholera. If there's lack of water and lack of clean water, then cholera becomes a huge issue. And this is just kind of one camp in one water distribution area where, you know, people are just continuously waiting and waiting and waiting. It took another 6 days for water to turn up in this camp after I took this picture. It kind of defines the scale. Those are all registered displaced in a camp in eastern Chad. This is thrashing their sorghum, so they're trying to separate the grain from the husk. And again, this is quite recently, last year, with a fresh wave of fighting and displaced rushing again from Darfur. For a period of time, a lot of them thought it was safe to go back, and they went back for a matter of weeks. And kind of the increased bombing last year has forced everyone back into the camps again. These are the trees that I was talking to you about earlier on, and we saw so many of these huge villages just waiting underneath the trees until nightfall, and they can move on. One of the success stories, which is Doctors Without Borders and people getting the help they need and a level of stability and security. So that kind of covers 2003 to 2008 in Darfur, Chad, Central African Republic. I mean, as I said earlier on, the solution to this issue, I really don't know what it is. Some other conflicts in the world, I can find a level of hope and a way of kind of taking us out of this. This one, I really don't know what the solution is. And I know, I'm sorry, but it's kind of a depressing way of leaving this particular part of the slideshow, but solutions to this, I'm lost on, completely lost, and quite obviously the international community is as well. But maybe it's a discussion we can have later on. This next set of pictures is a little bit more recent. It was just taken a couple of weeks ago. And again, I think it's quite topical. And the reason I put it in here is because we were talking a little earlier on about this issue of land. And again, if there's sort of some international policy students here, the issue of land in Africa is quite an important one, and it will become increasingly more so in the next decade. We've already seen it defined in Zimbabwe, and the reactions of Robert Mugabe in taking control of the farms, which to the most extent I agree with. I think the land should be controlled by those people that live in these areas. But what we're seeing now in Kenya is the same sort of issue, and constitutions that were put together very quickly in the 60s so that, you know, the then government could take control of the country, the land issue wasn't very well thought through. And I think with the increasing population that we're now seeing on the African continent, this issue of land is becoming more and more prevalent. And it's a very important, I think, issue that we should be continuously discussing. But this whole complex issue in Kenya has resulted in this fight over land. So everyone thinks that it's this started because of the problems with the elections. Well, you know, the fight that we're going to see now is two groups of people, the Kalenjin and the Kisii, two tribes who actually voted for the same person. They voted for the ODM, but they use the instability to pull up old ethnic and land issues that have been bubbling under the surface for many years. I think this now in Africa is going to be a story which is going to carry on, not just in Kenya, but South Africa and many other states too. This is where one tribe is trying to gain control and throw out from the land the other tribe. So this is a Kalenjin tribe burning a school that is owned by Kisii, or at least the headmaster is Kisii. But actually, the school is attended by both Kalenjin and Kisii. This is the futility of this whole thing, is that, you know, no one is actually benefiting. This is a pharmacy and a clinic that is being burnt by the Kalenjin because it's owned by a Kisii. But everyone gets their medication from it, the whole town, the Kisii and the Kalenjin were getting there, but still, let's burn it down. And this is a day where, I mean, the Kisii retaliated and burnt pretty much most of the Kalenjin part of town. Again, this is just a couple of weeks ago. So this kind of all happens on one day, this battle. And the next day, there's nothing left of this town. It's what is left of it is being dismantled by their owners. You know, they're taking down the pieces of wood that make up the doors. They're taking down the verandas. They're taking down the tin roofs, and they're putting it on a truck and they're moving home. So when we read in the newspapers and the magazines that there's been a political solution in Nairobi, and we're moving forward with this issue, I kind of disagree, because we have over 600,000-700,000 displaced people who have been essentially ethnically cleansed from their areas. So the Kalenjin can never come back to this town. You know, the Kisii can never go back over the other side. The Kikuyu can't travel further north than maybe 50 kilometers outside of Nairobi. And this ethnic cleansing that's gone on there is effective. Doctors, nurses, magistrates, policemen, military that have lived in areas for 40-odd years cannot go back there anymore. And it's going to take a generation for these people to be able to forgive and move forward. And I found it quite shocking that the international community again let this happen, but also ashamed that, two politicians created this, two Kenyan politicians created this hatred and allowed it to resurface. Again, one few light-hearted moments that you have. So our kids and what they can do with a bit of piece of string and a tree. And kids sometimes they amaze me on how they could just get on with life. And it's to me is a wonderful lesson that you know this can happen. This guy tried to sneak back out of a. This guy is Luwa tribe, and he tried to sneak back to his home to pick up some money that he had hidden under the bed, and was attacked by the Kikuyu and hacked to death by a machete. And again, in this town on this day, there were maybe 60 deaths that were very, very similar. And it wasn't just the adults that were being killed. There are roadblocks. This is a roadblock that was set up all around town. The trucks would be stopped and then burnt and looted. The towns and the houses that were occupied by tribes that were unfavored were burnt and the people chased out of the town. You'd go into towns and you'd see plumes of smoke all around, and it would be, okay, someone's been thrown out of this house, someone's been thrown out of this house, and it was very systematic, you know. This is the only house in this district that was being burnt, and it's actually a doctor who was a Luwa, and he had one of his doctors who was a Kikuyu in the house next door to him, and actually it's the Kikuyu doctor in the house next door to him that's trying to put out the fire with this pathetic hose. And so the people are happily themselves living next door to each other, but the politicians have stirred up such hatred that these kind of organized gangs wander into towns and identify the people that they need to move them out of the town, burn their houses, then move on to the next town. It's the only place that was left standing in this town, which is I found it kind of ironic that the result of the elections was this. Again, this is Kenya. This is why I'm not too sure if many of you are familiar with Africa, but Kenya for me has been a sanctuary. It's been the place I've always gone to after being in a conflict to rest and have a beer and see some friends and go on safari or do all of that before I go and cover a conflict. And actually to find myself covering a conflict in this country was bizarre for me. People leaving with their whole homes on the back of a truck. A man who's picking through what's left of his house. This guy was about 85. Really, the last few years of his life, and for it to be left like this. Again, this is whole families, whole homes were being kind of loaded on trucks and shipped to the other side of the country. They could drive through opposing tribes' areas, but if they stopped, they'd be killed. So, they were allowed to move in convoy through these areas protected by the military. But, yeah, it's a sad state, really sad state. So this is a country. Before I took those pictures in Kenya, I was actually going to go to Somalia, and I was supposed to be covering the situation in Mogadishu, And unfortunately, the people that I was going with, Doctors Without Borders, MSF, they had two staff that were killed in the region I was going to. So all of their staff had to pull out, and they still haven't gone back. It's a very sad situation. And the fact that Somalia, I think, is probably the most unstable place in the world right now, over and above Iraq and Afghanistan. No international aid workers are working there. There's very little international presence militarily, apart from the Ethiopians. And it's one of these countries we've just kind of forgotten and lost. But these are some images that I took a couple of months ago, last year, when I went in initially with MSF. And again, for me, this conflict is, I mean, it's, again, futile, desperate, and pointless. And like all conflicts are, but I can't understand why this one specifically even exists. There's again nothing to fight over. Unfortunately, there was, I think, up until 2005, a level of stability in the country until the American government decided that it would make a lot more sense to finance the Ethiopian invasion of the country to try and chase out Islamic insurgents. The Islamic courts had then, at that time, taken control of Somalia, and it had been for several months quite a stable place for the first time in almost a decade. And Mr. Bush decided that because of the Islamic courts taking over more than he would like, that he tried to then destabilize the Islamic courts, which is obviously happened, but has led to the changing instability of you know, millions of Somalis. They now live in these camps that they have no help. I was there at a time when there was an international presence. Now there's nothing. This is tuberculosis, and the situation of tuberculosis in Somalia is out of control. Again, this is a state that's a completely forgotten state. The structure has disappeared. There's nothing left. I mean, every single building is disintegrating. Every single road, well, the roads don't exist. Lack of 2 decades of lack of investment. It's really destroyed a place that at one time was quite beautiful. And the camps that we see we saw earlier on in the story from Kenya, these are the equivalent camps in Somalia. You can see the difference in assistance because of the lack of stability. Kind of the equivalent picture that we saw in Kenya earlier on. Now, most of my work over the last 10 years have been concentrating my efforts in a country called the Democratic Republic of Congo. And I'd like to show you a film, but I'll introduce you to the issue and talk you through some of the images and try to kind of give you an outline, but hopefully the film will give you an understanding of the problems. But I'll expand on a few of those because it's only a short film. Natural resource exploitation in DRC has been going on now under the rebel forces in the east of Congo for about a decade. The exploitation of gold, of coltan, of cassiterite, And it's the exploitation of these natural resources that I think we as an international community should be increasingly aware of and increasingly vigilant that we as consumers aren't fueling this conflict. And these kind of next images should hopefully define what's happening there a little bit. This is a gold mine in eastern Congo. And each of these rows are different rebel groups or different platoons within a rebel group. So they're all soldiers. This pit has been dug by hand over a period of several months. And they do it to extract the gold. The gold is then sold to or handed to the warlord, who then sends it to Uganda, and it's sold on the international gold market and ends up being traded in Zurich or Dubai or in the US. The money from this mining is then used to buy weapons to continue the conflict and maintain the security of these mines for the rebel forces. The guys that are working in these mines are either going to be soldiers, like these guys are, or it's going to be forced labor. And quite a lot of the people that are forced to work in these mines are kind of underneath some sort of bondage slavery in a way. I mean, their whole families will be working, breaking rocks and sifting through piles and piles of dirt to try and get this kind of this minutest piece of gold. Just so that they can get 50 cents a day from the warlord. But if they didn't do it, their family would be killed. So, I mean, they are getting paid a very small amount of money, but if they didn't do it, they'd surely be killed. This guy was accused of cannibalism. This was back in 2003, and the consumption of human flesh, especially in eastern Congo, is quite a widely used weapon in conflict. And it's the way that individual tribes can empower themselves with the spirit of their enemy. If you consume the flesh of the dead enemy, then you empower yourself with their spirit. And this guy had just been accused of cannibalism in this village and was killed quite soon after this picture was taken. Huge villages are ransacked and burnt as, again, tribal conflicts move from one side to another. Machetes and decapitation are happening a little less frequently in the last year, but still horrific tools. Again, here, child soldiers. Thomas Lubanga who was one of the rebel leaders, is now in The Hague at the International Criminal Court, and hopefully will be the first warlord to be tried at the ICC and found guilty. He's there. Being prosecuted for the use of child soldiers. Again, this is another example that this lady tried to protect her son and they hacked off her arm and consumed it in front of her. They cooked it and they ate it in front of her. The displaced, these are displaced, kind of fleeing one of the conflicts in a town called Fataki, where this guy is heading to. Now, the children in this part of the world, the children that are fighting, they're more products of attacks on villages and families being killed, and then the children will be forced to follow the military, and over time given a weapon and they fight. And 2003, 2004, up until just this year, actually. These children are being used a little bit less so since 2006. I mean, they're still, just last year I saw a lot of these guys being re-recruited. A lot of the time there are waves in conflict, and 2003 was a very bad time in Congo. 2004, it was very peaceful. 2005, very bad time. 2007, a very bad time. 2008. There was a kind of a lull at the end of 2007, and now again, 2008, it's starting up again. And these recruitments are kind of following these waves of conflict. But, when they're not fighting, these children are forced to work in the mines extracting gold. The money men. Again, this insecurity leads to a fundamental breakdown of the healthcare system. So the lack of access to healthcare has been the reason why 5.4 million people have died in DRC in the last 10 years. It's like the biggest death toll in the world since the Second World War. And this is the reason why it's happening. It's because people can't get hold of the drugs. They can't get access to care because it's just too dangerous to either send the care in there, send the drugs in there, or it's too dangerous for them to go to a place where they can receive it. We were talking about bonded slavery earlier on. This is a family kind of working in one of the mines as bonded slaves. This is Catherine. She had her leg not amputated, but she was attacked by a machete. And she was coming out of the bush. Her two brothers were carrying her out of the bush to try and find some medication. And they actually found some. It was like an antiseptic powder. So they rewashed the bandages and sprinkled this antiseptic powder on and took her back into the bush. But that's kind of the extent of the medical care that you can get. That's it. I mean, the worst part of this conflict for me is the seeing this, actually. So on this day, I was in this camp, and there were 24 funerals. And they were all of children under the age of 5. Again, you can see it's the state of the camps are pretty poor, given that there's supposed to be a huge amount of aid going into DRC. This is a service in the morning in one of the camps. We were talking about print media and how, as journalists, you can get your message across and maintain awareness. And the traditional method for us is to use magazines, newspapers, to try and get this stuff out so that people can kind of understand a little bit more about what's going on. But increasingly, I think the message is changing, and the audience, our next generation of the concern, people that are going to be the people that are going to make a difference and make change in this world, are consuming their news slightly differently. And so we have to think of alternative ways of doing this. And so having images like this in a magazine sometimes doesn't get to the people that it's supposed to get to. So we have to come up with alternative solutions. And what I'll try and show you in a minute is one of the ways we tried to combat that and get to an audience that are more powerful and have the power to effect change. That, you know, I'm just a conduit, I just take pictures, but there are people out there that have a lot more power and a lot more power to effect change. It's just getting these images and getting this message in front of them so that they can make and react to this situation and speak to either the people that are financing the problem or speak to the politicians that have the power to make policy that will change, hopefully, this sort of situation. So we'll have a look at that in a minute. Again, lack of access to medication is just really where the main problem for these kids. It's probably the only happy picture I've taken in my life. I spent too long in places where this is happening. But it's nice to see some joy. There is joy, but unfortunately in the camps, you don't see it very often. My personal statement about the effectiveness of the UN. An organization that is it's the largest United Nations presence in the world is in DRC. But their effectiveness is pretty limited. And for me, you know, the sad thing is this country is such a beautiful country. This is the River Congo. I've had the pleasure of traveling on many, many months of it. Such a beautiful country. And if this conflict could stop, it'd be certainly, tourism would be enormous there. These are rebuilding their houses after they've kind of repatriated a village. Again, child soldiers, the age of these kids, some of them are 7 or 8. So young. The elections were financed by the international community in 2006, and Joseph Kabila was elected president. And these images kind of reflect that issue. The bizarre thing was quite a lot of the election was fought on having access to electricity, but then quite a lot of the count went on it in candlelight. What I'll show you now is how we can represent. I was talking earlier on about how images and how journalism is changing, and how we are trying to react to that. And this is a film that I made, not necessarily for consumption within the journalism side. Awareness is a very good thing, and I think that what we have managed to do with this is get younger, more less traditional consumers of news, less traditional consumers of the magazine world. For example, you know, I have a nephew who's 16. He's never read a newspaper in his life. He's never bought a magazine. You know, he doesn't contemplate the idea of doing any of that, because he consumes anything that he needs through the internet, and everything that he is consuming in terms of news is electronic. And so I think as journalists, and also as, you know, the aid community, we have to kind of address that and think about solutions where we can maybe affect and get to that different audience. And this is one of the ways that some of that work that you've just seen has been used. I'll show you this, and maybe we can kind of discuss that a little later on. Are we okay for sound here? Congo is gifted with enormous natural resources. It has diamonds, gold, vast amounts of water, coltan, cassiterite. It could and should be a very, very rich country. But in fact, what the reality has been in the past years is that these natural resources have been a curse. It's created a conflict led by warlords that are trying to take the natural resources from DRC for their own gains. The warlords have been recruiting child soldiers, and in the last 10 years, more than 30,000 child soldiers have been recruited in eastern Congo, many of whom are still serving now. The local mining population doesn't really know the value of what it is they're extracting, and so they rely on intermediaries to tell them what the price of that gold is. And those intermediaries inevitably don't tell them the right price, and the increases in prices on the international markets are never passed down to the people that are extracting that gold from the gold fields. Many of the children that were forced to fight to gain control of the mines, they put down the Kalashnikov that they were made to carry 12 months earlier, and they pick up a shovel, and they're forced to work in the mines digging for gold for the warlords. And many hundreds of children have died, being buried alive in the tunnels in the gold fields of eastern Congo. Joseph Kabila was the elected president and has been ruling the country ever since. His response to the elections and his newfound power was to eradicate the political opposition. He arrested many of the opposition activists, and these billions of dollars that have been spent on the Congolese election have essentially been wasted, because there is now no democracy in Congo. The Congolese have had this history of being led by dictators who look out for only themselves. They steal the vast natural resources that DRC has, and the Congolese people receive no benefits. The Congolese people only suffer as a result of the lack of social structure that this pillaging creates. But this is not exactly a great lesson for the Congolese people, who see their leaders as thieves. That filters down through every level of society. The military will use their AK-47, their Kalashnikovs, to reap the benefits of war. They'll pillage, they'll rape, they'll steal cattle, they'll steal goats, they'll take a chicken at gunpoint just so that they can eat, because they're essentially not getting paid by anyone. When there's increased military activity in certain areas to try and secure the natural resources, the population inevitably starts to run. The displaced in Congo number in their millions. They have no access to any medical care, any health care. Sometimes they have to walk for days before they arrive in safety. More than 90% of the people who die in Congo are dying because of the lack of access to medication. And this lack of access to medication is caused by the overall insecurity. Just the very smallest of illnesses like diarrhea, the most basic of sicknesses like malaria, which warrant just a small series of pills they have no access to this sort of medication because they've probably been stolen by the military. As a result, you have many millions dying because of the lack of access to the most basic healthcare. Over the past years in DRC, sexual violence has been an enormous problem. Just in 2007 alone, there are 40,000 reported rape cases. It's happening in every town, in every province. Anywhere there's military activity, sexual violence is prevalent, and it's a daily fear for every woman. The government soldiers and the warlords are equally culpable. The military may be arrested, he may spend 6 or 7 days in jail, but then he'll be out again. And he could find himself passing the woman that he raped just weeks after he was found guilty of the crime. The women, they whisper to you what happened to them because they're so ashamed of what it was that was committed against them. In one province alone, there were recorded 40 women being raped every day. 13% of those being raped were under the age of 14, and 10 to 12% of those that were raped contracted HIV. These problems and these statistics are just horrific and so huge that we sometimes can't even contemplate the severity of the problem there. But still, the international community does nothing. The problems in Congo are vast, and sometimes the whole problem feels just too huge to fix. This is the largest death toll in the world since the Second World War, but it's not a problem that is unsolvable. It's not a problem that we can't do anything about. I think there's one thing that we can do as consumers, and that is be aware of where our natural resources come from. When you're buying gold, when you're buying diamonds, ask the retailer if they know where they're coming from. And that's one of the ways that we as consumers can maintain pressure on an industry that is sometimes not as diligent as it can be. One of the main things that will bring Congo out of the situation that's in at the moment is education. There are great organizations that are working in DRC. Save the Children, UNICEF, Human Rights Watch is doing an enormous amount of work. And organizations such as UNHCR are providing the stability and the infrastructure to allow the children to receive some form of education. If we maintain good level of education amongst the population, there is always a hope that the future will be better.
A better educated population leads to better questions, and a better questioning population leads to a better government.
Thank you, Marcus, for your work and what you have shown. I'm actually from Goma. It's Eastern Congo, and this is actually the part that, you know, you have shown there. And this,
can you put the mic just a little closer to your, so people can hear? It's cool.
This is a subject that's really, really close to me because this is where I'm from. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions is that I've seen a lot of reports on the current situation in Congo, but very few report on the actual the origin of the war. As a young Congolese in 1996 in Congo, I had never foreseen this. Mm-hmm. So this is shocking, and it's. I've realized that the media has not really studied or really looked into the origin of this issue of the beginning of the war. Is that something you intend to do, or?
I mean, I've been trying to keep this in the news for the last 10 years, and it's very difficult. It's very difficult to make sure that the magazines and the newspapers are aware. And that's in a way, this multimedia piece was a response to that. You know, I kind of realized that normal media channels are probably not the most effective way of using this work and getting the work and getting the and explaining the source of the conflict, the reasons behind the conflict, to those people that have the power to effect some sort of change over that is going to be a lot more effective than having 8 pages of pictures in Newsweek or Time magazine or the New York Times magazine. Getting these images and this body of work in front of people in Congress, in getting it in front of the board and the financiers of companies like AngloGold Ashanti and Barrick Gold, getting it in front of gold traders in Chicago or in New York. That's where the power of using this sort of work has come from. So that's how we're working with this body of work now.
Okay, the last question is, it's something a little more personal from your point of view. Why do you think, from your first-hand experience, why do you think that warlords feel so much at home in Congo, even though the United Nations has deployed the largest peacekeeping
force
in the region, and also what do you think of the involvement of the neighboring countries, Uganda and Rwanda?
Well, even though it's the largest UN peacekeeping force, it's probably one of the most ineffective. And the ability of the UN to control the conflict there and to use in full the Chapter 7 mandate that they have in DRC, which is one of the few places they have it, but they don't use it. Chapter 7 is kind of the use of controllable force to maintain stability, whereas Chapter 6, which is what happens in most countries, is that they're not allowed to use force, they're there to observe. But in Congo they have Chapter 7, so they can actually use force if they want to. And they very rarely do that. And that, as a result, you know, the warlords, they know the control and they know the levels that the UN will go to before they pull back. And I think it's a very ineffective mission, very badly run, very badly led UN mission, especially on a military level in DRC. And, it's a shame. The involvement of Rwanda and Uganda, well, I mean, what can you... It's quite obvious there is a huge involvement in Rwanda and Uganda. Both on financing and also purchasing of the natural resources and allowing those natural resources to pass through their country. That's down to international pressure of the international community on those two countries, threatening of withdrawing of aid to those countries to try and put pressure on them to not be involved. But it's very easy to hide weapon stashes. It's very easy to smuggle weapon stashes. You know, if the US can't control effectively a border between its own country, between the US and Mexico, how do you expect Congo to control a border between Rwanda? And how do you expect Congo to control a border between it and Uganda? So it's a very porous situation there, and it's very difficult to control the flow of arms and the flow of finance. But I think it's down to the international community maintaining pressure, and you know, also people out there doing the research and making sure and getting evidence that it's still ongoing, because there's very little evidence since 2006 when the UN did their last survey out there that this is ongoing. It's absolutely still ongoing, but we need to maintain that pressure and keep it in the public eye.
I wanted to thank you for your poignant images. I was in the Central African Republic with Doctors Without Borders about a year ago, and I think you really captured what it's like to be in a forgotten place like that. But I was curious about where you get your information. You mentioned Darfur, you know, back before it was in the news and no one paying you to go there. Where do you get your information about the underreported crises?
Mostly from MSF, Doctors Without Borders. organizations like MSF or Doctors Without Borders, they're always in the field, and they're always a great source of information and a great source of research material. So I have contacts dotted around the world, and I just give them a call, essentially. But there are local journalists as well, and they're working on websites such as AlertNet, which is a great source of local knowledge, and also it's kind of funded into by Reuters, but also a lot of the NGOs have access to that and post blogs on there, so you get a lot of information. It's alertnet.org. And they also have every week a humanitarian kind of what's going on around the world kind of overview. So it keeps people well informed and gives you links to where you can find out more information. So it's a good source.
Hi. How did you arrange transport with those different military groups?
You get on the phone and you call them. I mean, they have offices in London. They have offices in Frankfurt, Paris, London. I mean, they have a political arm to the what otherwise looks as like a ragtag bunch of guys on the back of a 4x4. It's actually, you know, quite a well-organized political organization that has representation in a lot of the cities around the world, and you just call them up.
Did you travel with the rebel groups also?
Yeah, most of those pictures were from the SLA, the rebel groups. But, I mean, you obviously have to get to those areas, so you have to smuggle yourself across the border to get access to them. But once you go across the border, then you can spend as long as you want there.
I just wanted to say, photojournalism is an extremely dangerous thing. Can you give an example of a particularly tense conflict that you were involved in, and what keeps you doing it?
It's not photojournalism that's dangerous, it's the bullets. But they're all pretty dangerous, you know, at different times. You know, I think there's a misconception that I was talking about this earlier on with another group. It's a misconception that you're under fire 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days. That's not the case at all. You know, most of the time I live in Goma or in Kisangani or Kinshasa, and there's no significant problem in those areas. But then you make a choice that you have a certain issue that you want to cover, or a certain village that you want to go and see, or a certain skirmish or conflict that you want to report on, or a certain mine that you want to go and visit. And that, obviously, that needing to travel to the bush puts you in situations where things are slightly insecure. But that's just the nature of the job. I mean, I'd say there are only more than a handful of situations where I think, situations that I wouldn't tell my mother about you know. but you know, there's a general tension the whole time, but the kind of being under fire is not, it's not something that's happened very often, maybe 6 or 7 times. And why do I do it? I think it's the best job in the world. So I still can't believe that some people pay me to do this, you know. They send me around the world and I have a chance to see history unfold. I have the chance to provide some tools that can maybe influence the outcome of that. I think that's a phenomenal job. Certainly better than sitting behind a desk, anyway. My wife doesn't agree sometimes, but... Okay, well, thanks very much indeed. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.